Today's Teisho will be on case 25 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan. Case 25 is entitled Kyozan's Dream. In a dream, Kyozan Osho went to Maitreya's palace and was led in to sit in the third seat. A senior monk struck with a gavel and said, "Today the one in the third seat will speak." Kyozan rose and, striking with the gavel, said, "The truth of Mahayana is beyond the four propositions and transcends the 100 negations. Taicho, Taicho, hear the truth." Mumon's comment. Now tell me, did Kyozan preach or did he not? If he opens his mouth, he is lost. If he seals his mouth, he is lost. Even if he neither opens nor shuts his mouth, he is 108,000 miles away from the truth. Mumon's verse. In the bright daylight, under the blue sky, he forges a dream in a dream. He makes up a monstrous story and tries to deceive the whole crowd. To thank everybody for coming here this morning to practice Zen. It's a really beautiful way to spend a Saturday morning sitting together. When you first started doing Zen, you might have read something about Zen, or you might have heard about our group from somebody. Perhaps you saw an advertisement in the Targum. I don't know how exactly it happened, but you wound up here. Most people who come to Zen practice are looking for something, and they're not always exactly sure what, but they feel that something's missing in their lives. And some people come and practice Zen, and it's deeply moving somehow. People sit down on the cushion, they watch the breath, and they feel somehow better after going through that process. And they probably don't understand it. I myself don't fully understand even now why I feel better when I sit. But I know that when I first came to practice Zen, and I first did meditation, it was tremendously hard for me physically. Being still and sitting on the mat were challenging. Also, having half lotus or later full lotus was quite difficult for me. But nevertheless, when I would get off the cushion, I felt very much better. And to me, that's always been a big mystery. You know, what is it about this practice that feels so much better? I think that a lot has to do with ordinary consciousness and Zen consciousness. You know, ordinary consciousness is often feels rather separate. Rather separate from things. So, you know, when I was a little kid, I was really shy. You know, I was a shy little kid. And I remember going to school. I can still remember my kindergarten room. I really can. I was thinking about it this morning. I had a wonderful, wonderful kindergarten teacher whose name I can't remember. I can remember my kindergarten teacher's face. And she, very kind, very generous woman. I just think they should have valued her very highly because she made us all feel pretty safe, pretty good. But I can remember going to school and being very nervous about all these unfamiliar kids. You know, I can remember my anxiety. You know, and somehow my teacher, I think her name was Mrs. Stoddard. That seems to be coming back. I think Mrs. Stoddard made us feel very safe, very, very warm and protected. We used to have to bring a towel to school. And in the middle of our kindergarten day, we had to take a nap. And we'd put our towels on the ground. And we'd lie on the towel. And our teacher would walk around and make sure that we had our fingers were curled so that we were properly relaxed. Isn't that charming? And we would lie down on the towel and we would have a little rest period. And she would walk around and just make sure everybody was quiet, and then our fingers were curled so that, and our shoes were off, so that we could really be rested. And I think they turned down the lights. And maybe we actually slept a little bit. I don't know. But we did lots of fun things in school. We worked with paints. We used to use all these bright colors, reds and yellows, and we had a kind of paper that was shiny on one side, and you could take this paint and finger paint with it, so it was fun to put your fingers in the gooey paint, and then you could make designs in the paint. And the paint was bright screaming yellow, bright screaming blue, and it was just fun to paint on these big sheets of paper which were shiny on one side, so you could slide your fingers around with the paint. And that was really fun. And I remember another thing we did was, I think on Mother's Day, the teacher brought in a camera, and she took a picture of each of us with one of these instant cameras, and we were supposed to take popsicle sticks and make a little frame for the picture. So we all made our frames and we painted them blue or red or yellow, and we could put glitter on them. And then the teacher basically stapled the picture into the frame, and we could take it home and give it to our mothers. And it was wonderful. I remember having very good memories of kindergarten. I can remember going to school and being very nervous about it and being very afraid, you know. And, you know, when you're a little kid, if you're gregarious, if you're one of these, some people are just very gregarious. They open up right away and they make friends very quickly. And I wasn't like that. So, you know, going to school caused me a little bit of stress, and I was afraid of the other kids at first. You know, just didn't know what was going to happen. I lived in a tough neighborhood in Baltimore. There were, you know, kids who would beat you up, and there were bullies. You know, you had to watch out for the bullies. And so when I got to school, I didn't know what to expect. But Mrs. Stoddard created this atmosphere which was very, very nice, very beautiful, and safe, protective, and even now, after all these years, after so many years, maybe 50 years, I can still remember that class and how happy and safe I felt in that place, and also energized. You know, energized. There, you know, sometimes you're going down the street, and maybe you feel uneasy, you feel tense. If you're in New York or you're in a big city, you know, you can the noise and the press of the crowd. Maybe you have a deadline. You can feel very very disconnected, very unsafe. But sometimes you'll notice that you feel very connected, very safe, very very alive. You know, I don't know if this is making any sense, but sometimes you're in this place. It's not a physical place, but you're in this place where it's like my kindergarten. You know, it's all of a sudden the world becomes embracing you. It embraces you, you know. Sometimes it's not like that, of course. Sometimes we feel very separate, very separate. But sometimes the world is it's like suddenly you feel like you're being embraced by the world. It's like the world's putting its arms around you and holding you. And sometimes this is what happens to us on the cushion in Zazen, you know. You can get this feeling like the world is just putting its arms around you in Zazen. And that's a wonderful feeling. That happens to me quite often, actually. And it's quite a beautiful feeling. There's a way of experiencing the world which is tense, separated, nervous, anxious, you know, and on the lookout for bullies and so on. And then there's this other way of experiencing the world where you feel very much at ease and very, very safe and connected. Yeah. Now, usually, if you feel that sense of safety or connectedness, there's also a feeling of, sooner or later, there's a feeling of like energy, yeah? And this feeling of energy is very important, of aliveness or energy, you know. In Chinese tradition, this is called being in harmony with the Tao, you know. This is condition of connectedness, safety, feeling that you're at home, feeling that you're in the right place, and then this sort of spontaneous energy. This is very important. This is being in the Tao, right? Sometimes we're not in the Tao. You know, we feel edgy, nervous, you know, we're unhappy, we're suspicious, you know, and things can make us that way. You know, it's not necessarily our fault. Sometimes for me, school was incredibly boring. I can remember just sitting in class and being so bored, so just absolutely bored, and going through the motions all day long, you know. So I'd go to this class and I'd sit in that and listen to the teacher, and then I'd go to this class and listen to the teacher, and you know, I'd go to lunch and you see the same people every day, and then you get on the school bus and the school bus drives you home, you know. And you're as an adult, your life can be like this too, where you're just going through the motions, you know. You might not feel threatened by things. It might not feel anxious, but it's not alive. You know, sometimes in our lives we are going through the motions. We're not alive, you know. You're going to your job. You're doing what you have to do. You're going to school. You're doing what you have to do, but there's something missing, right? Something missing. And I think this is why people come to Zen, because they're looking for that feeling. They're looking for that connectedness that we don't always have. You know, sometimes people have just like this tremendous sense of no energy. It's like no energy, you know, or no... I guess that's the best way to put it. When I was a kid, on television, they used to sell a product called Geritol. And Geritol was supposed to give you energy. And it was very popular. It was on TV all the time. They were selling these bottles of Geritol. And if you took Geritol, you would have energy. And there was a guy who used to say, "Do you suffer from iron poor blood?" And the idea was that millions of Americans didn't have enough iron in their blood and they needed Geritol, and they were just dragging their asses around, you know. Okay. And Geritol was supposed to solve this problem. And, you know, as I realize now that lots of people do go through life, you know, if they're not very agitated and nervous, they're going through life sort of going through the motions. And a lot of the time they feel just sort of dead or not fully alive. You know, if dead maybe is too strong, but not fully alive. You know, you're going through the motions, and then all of a sudden, you know, something might happen to you. Something might change, and you suddenly feel this, as I say, this feeling of like being protected, being safe, being at home, and energy, you know. The other day, I wasn't here for the sit on Wednesday night because I had to giving this paper at this at a university nearby, I had a lot of things to do before I gave the paper, and so I got up like at 4:30 and I sat on Wednesday morning, and then I had to work on the paper, and I got the paper sort of into presentable shape, and then I had all this stuff to do in the afternoon before I left for this university. And it was really very hectic, and by the time I got to, it was Seton Hall, by the time I got to Seton Hall, I was really tired, and I actually had a big cup of coffee before I gave my paper, and then we went out to an Indian restaurant, because I told everybody I was a vegetarian, and then the next morning I got up, and I was really tired from all of this, you know. So I had to go in and teach, and I went in and taught, and I was very, very tired. And then around 2 o'clock, I just decided I'm going to go home. I'm too tired to get anything done. And I went with my wife up to the Montclair Museum, where they were having a show by an artist I like. His name is Will Barnett. And, you know, all this time I had just been sort of like going through the motions, you know. I got on the Garden State Parkway, and we drove up. I drove through Bloomfield. I drove into Montclair, and I got to the museum. And I got out of the car, and I went into the museum. And I walked, you know, paid my admission fee, and I walked in, and then I walked into this room, and there were these paintings by Will Barnett. And he's really an abstract expressionist. He has a lot of different styles, but he's really an abstract painter. And I walked into this room where his paintings were, and all of a sudden, it was like a change, right? It was like something changed in me, and I suddenly felt, you know, like a calm, safe, and this energy, this wonderful feeling of energy. And, you know, there is somehow these paintings really, we could say, spoke to me. You know, if you were to do a graph, you know, it would be like energy level. And it would just be close to the bottom of the graph going horizontally. And then all of a sudden when you get to the Will Barnett paintings, there'd be a spike, right? It would be spiking up, and there'd be a lot of energy, right? And that was the effect of these paintings on me. You know, that all of a sudden, it was like a qualitative difference, right? A qualitative difference, you know, in how I was experiencing the world. The other day, I was listening. I am a subscriber to Rhapsody. I don't know if you know about that music service, but for about $10 a month, you can get unlimited music on Rhapsody, and they have quite a huge collection. And so, I am a big fan of John Adams, the composer John Adams, and he has a wonderful piece of music called The Dharma at Big Sur, and it's inspired by California Buddhism. And I strongly recommend that you listen to it because it's absolutely wonderful, right? And I didn't, of course, I didn't know this. I had heard a small piece of it at one time. And then I thought, well, why don't I listen to the Dharma at Big Sur? So I put on, I got online to Rhapsody, and anyway, I clicked on to, there's an album called The Dharma at Big Sur by John, the composer John Adams, and it was just absolutely splendid. And again, it was all of a sudden, you know, I'm just sort of grading papers, answering emails, you know, blah, 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 you know. And all of a sudden I put this music on and it was just glorious, right? It's like the energy went, you know, okay. Big energy, right? Beautiful. And I felt so alive. It was like sort of rapturously alive, right? You know? This is like, this is very, very important. Very important. You know, we don't really have a good vocabulary to talk about this in the West because, you know, in the West we say something is objectively true or subjective. Right? It's objective or subjective, you know. And so, you know, people will say, oh, it's all in your head, right? Meaning you're imagining things. The objective is real and the subjective is not real, right? And so our culture doesn't encourage us to pay attention to the quality of our experiences, you know. Listening to music, watching a painting, watching TV, all of these things could in theory be the same, right? They're all experiences. But some things make us feel alive in this very, very dramatic way. And some things don't, you know. Sometimes we're just hovering at the bottom of the graph. We're just going along. And we're feeling kind of, alive, but just barely. You know, still, it's like the batteries are still there. They're still working, but not much is happening. And then every once in a while, something will happen, and it will be, all of a sudden, you'll feel very alive, very energetic, very connected. And listening to John Adams was like that. It was like, oh my gosh, that is so beautiful, right? It really brought me to life, right? And going into the museum when I saw these paintings by this man, Will Barnett, I felt so, it wasn't the same, exactly the same experience, but I felt so alive. And his paintings were very, very moving to me, these abstract forms in very muted earth tones. And the story of Will Barnett is so interesting. You know, he's 100 years old, and he's still painting. He came to New York from New England during the 1930s, during the Great Depression. He wanted to be a painter, and he went to New York because that was where the action was. And he said he had $10 in his pocket, you know. He found a community of artists working in New York City. A lot of artists lived in the city at that time because it was actually cheap to live there. It was you could live cheaply in New York, and there were jobs, you know. So he eventually he started painting. And he eventually went to one of the art institutes in New York, and he eventually went over to Europe for a while and studied in Europe. He came back, and he's been painting ever since. And he's gone through many different styles, and I just thought it was such a remarkable story. This is a person who has literally given his life to painting. And of course, when he talks about painting, he's just totally committed to the kind of experience he gets when he paints. You know, it makes it, it's very clear that painting puts him in a space or in a place that's very important to him, right? I mean, when he paints, he feels connected to the world. He feels alive. And this is why he's painting, you know, he's still painting at 100. You know, these paintings were so serene and earthy. I just felt I was, you know, in the presence of the earth spirits. You know, these colors were so powerfully earthy, muted, a little bit washed out, but very powerful. These deep or soft browns, soft greens, sort of turquoise colors, very beautiful. And then I went downstairs, and they have a children's art program. And they had little kids working with paints, you know, just like when I was a little kid, down in the basement. And these kids were having such a good time, you know. They were so excited, and they were, you know, working with these paints, and their eyes looked very bright. And they had an art show of paintings by students at various age groups, and some of the paintings were just absolutely, some of the artwork was just absolutely wonderful. I just thought, how could high school students have done work of such sophistication? It was really amazing. And I think the answer is that the teachers are able to get the students into that place where they feel safe, connected, and finally energized, right? And this is very important, you know. If people spend too much time at the bottom of the graph, you know, it's not healthy for us mentally and or physically, you know. It's important to find things in your life that that bring you to life, that bring you to life. And it can be your work, you know. Some people just are absolutely alive when they're at work. You know, they're really harmonized with the Tao. It doesn't have to be easy, you know. Sometimes things can be very, very difficult, but you feel alive and you feel like you're in the flow or you're in the stream of things, and that feeling's very crucial. And then sometimes we don't feel that way. But it's important to be sensitive to those moments in life where you feel alive, or you feel alive. Now, you know, when I do meditation, I feel alive. You know, people think of meditation as like mental tranquilization, you know. So last night, I have to say, I was really exhausted, and during the first sit, I slept. So I was tranquilized then, you know. But generally speaking, when I sit on the cushion, I feel alive. I have that feeling like life is putting its arms around me, and then I begin to feel this energy, you know. And other things I do, like I like to walk or run outside, and I have a nice route where there's lots of trees and. And, you know, it's very beautiful, very pretty. And when I do that, again, I feel energized and alive and safe, you know. And this is real. This is real. You know, in the West, we don't have a vocabulary. The Chinese had this idea of the Tao, of being in harmony with the Tao. And this is, like, totally different from our way of thinking, because we think something's objective or something's subjective. And the Chinese way of thinking is it's all about the relationship. It's not in the thing and it's not in the person. It's about the relationship. So in some contexts, in some relationships, we feel alive, right? And in some circumstances, we feel dead or just barely going along, right? And And so it's important to, you could think of it as part of your practice, really, to be sensitive to or be aware of those moments in life when you feel alive. And you could think of that as practice, as part of your practice, you know. If running makes you feel more alive, that's part of your practice. You know, that being sensitive to that feeling of connectedness, that feeling of aliveness, and sort of pursuing that is very important. That would be, from a Zen standpoint, a life well lived, right? Is a life where you spend a lot of time in that energy, in the Tao, right? And of course, in early life, one of the difficulties is finding those things that make you feel that way, and then having the confidence to make them part of your life, you know. So a lot of the time, when we're young, we're going through the motions, right? You know, we're going through the motions, we might notice that we feel more alive, but often people are so insecure. You know, when people are young, they tend to be, especially after you are about 13, you know, so much of what we're focused on is the opinion of other people. So you know, adolescents really are not fully formed human beings, and they're sort of looking around imitating others, actually often to get their approval. You know, this is very common. So teenagers often aren't doing things to please themselves. They're actually doing things so that they'll be socially acceptable. This is a huge anxiety for young people. And you know, as we go to college, you know, we're really doing something that's expected of us socially, right? And so there's a kind of like a peer pressure, and then there's social pressure, and we're pleasing our parents, we're pleasing our peers. And we might not be aware that some things bring us alive and some things don't. But it's very important to begin to notice the things that really bring you alive. And to sort of, that's part of living a cultivated life. The Zen life is about doing things that create that awareness, create that sense of things. You know, my second teacher, My second teacher, Webb Roshi, went to Japan to study art. He had no interest in meditation at all. He was a graduate student at the University of Chicago, and he wanted to study Japanese art, and he went to I think it was Myoshinji, because there was a very famous painting called The Five Persimmons. And it's a masterpiece of Japanese art. It's all done in ink on rice paper. And I think it's called The Five Persimmons. And I actually think there are six persimmons. I think maybe that's a koan. But there's a beautiful image of just five persimmons in a row. And they're very, very simply done. You know, just very, very simply done. And anyway, Webb wanted to see this and some other paintings that were at Myoshinji, and when he went there, the teacher, the abbot, said, you can't see them unless you do Zazen, because you won't understand them unless you do Zazen. So anyway, Webb stayed there and did some Zazen, and eventually got into it in a big way. And he actually trained for a number of years, for a fairly long time, at Myoshinji as a monk. Eventually, when he finished his training, he went out to the bathroom one day. And by the way, you might know this, in Asia, traditionally, they didn't have toilets. Toilets are like a Western idea. They have like a hole in the ground or a hole in the floor. There's just a hole, and you squat down and you urinate or defecate into the hole. And a lot of Japanese temples typically have bathrooms like this, right? So Webb went into the stall, and he was squatting down, and he looked next to the place where he was going to take a dump, and there was a scroll. And he opened the scroll, and it was the Five Persimmons, right? Which is like this national masterpiece, and it's worth millions of dollars. And it was the real thing. The teacher was telling him something about what's really important. And it's not the multiple million-dollar price tag. It's the quality of the experience. And so Zen people aren't so impressed by the art world. They have a different standard. And the teacher was saying, look, you know, what really matters is your experience of this painting, not the painting itself. But anyway, Webb finished his training, and he came back to the United States, and he helped to start the Seattle Zen Center, where I trained. But then an interesting thing happened to him. He happened to go to a tea ceremony, and the tea ceremony absolutely blew him away. If you've ever seen a Chado ceremony, it's quite simple. And you can go online and you can play there's a number of videos of real Japanese tea ceremonies online. You take some hot water from a boiling kettle with a bamboo cup, and you add it to a tea bowl which has powdered green tea, and you whisk it with a bamboo whisk, which is like a little kitchen whisk that we use, but it's made out of bamboo, and then you serve the tea in a beautiful bowl, and that's it. But the ceremony is quite beautiful, and in Webb's case, it literally it caused him to become very excited, very energized. That feeling was so powerful that he decided to start studying tea ceremony seriously. And he would go every summer to Urasenke in Japan and practice tea ceremony there with a number of very famous tea masters. And he became a deeply accomplished tea person. And he did it because it created this powerful sense of well-being, safety, connectedness, and then energy, right? Living in that energy is the Zen life. You know, so the Zen life isn't just about sitting on the cushion all the time, although it's important to do a lot of Zazen. The Zen life is lived off the cushion if you can find the things that make you feel alive, you know. And skillful people try to build their lives around those things, you know. Will Barnett wouldn't have been painting at 100 if it didn't make him feel alive, you know. And when you look at somebody like Picasso, you know, Picasso was so incredibly prolific. And I was just reading something about a painter in Virginia whose work I know. And he said, I do 5 paintings a week. And I looked at the painting, and it was just magical. I thought, my God, you do 5 of these a week, you know. How can people do that? Well, it's not work for them. It's like play. It's because they're in that energy. You know, they're in that energy. And Barnett said in the piece I was reading about him, Will Barnett, he said, I used to paint 8 or 9 hours a day. And he said, now I'm 100, so I'm down to 4 hours a day, which is, you know, pretty good. The point is that he's in the Tao. He's in the Tao. Now, it can be complicated for another reason as well. And this is where life gets challenging. Challenging. You know, if you one day discover that you feel alive when you paint, you know, you feel alive when you paint, that's a wonderful moment. And you could go to art school and study painting, and you could get a degree in painting, and you could paint, you know? And as long as you're painting and enjoying the painting, you're in heaven, right? That's the ideal situation. Okay, now, however, there's a complication, right? Somebody says, why don't you enter your paintings into the contest? You know, there's a contest. So you pick out three of your best paintings and you submit them to the contest. And you say to yourself, look, when I've painted these pictures, I've been in the Tao. I've been in the energy. Everything has unfolded naturally. I felt alive. I felt timeless. You know, lightning struck. So you send them off to the judges, and the judges go, we don't think so. See? Now that's a really difficult moment. See? That's very, very difficult. We can start out feeling very separate from things. And that's an unhealthy situation where we feel separate. And all through life, you know, that experience can be very prominent. But sometimes we find a way to connect with life. And it's like being a child again. It's like innocence, or it's like it's the fulfillment of our lives as human beings. We get disconnected from the world as we grow up, and then we reconnect, and it's like going home again. And this is what Buddhism is all about, is reconnecting, see? Okay, so now we're connected again, but we live in a social world, right? And so we've done these beautiful paintings, we've felt totally alive, our heads were full of light as we painted, and then we send them to the judges, and the judges don't go, what we're hoping is the judges will go, oh my God, was this person in the Tao? You know, give him the prize, right? First prize, and they pin it on, right? A big bow. But what happens if that doesn't happen, right? And you look at the painting they gave the award to, and you think, well, that's no good, right? And maybe the guy who got the award is a wonderful painter too, and maybe he's just a friend of the judge, you know? Hard to say. But, you know, that's a bit of a shock, because now that separation is back, see? We were separated, we've got connected, we were dancing in the sun, we were having a wonderful time, and now, disconnected, you know? Now this is very difficult. This is one of the most challenging things that can happen in life, right? You know, we're disconnected, we connect, the universe is unified and whole, and then somebody pulls the rug out from under us, right? And we're disconnected again. And this is the most challenging kind of experience. You know, it takes a million different forms, but when this happens, it's very difficult to deal with, right? I mean, I know. It hurts, right? It hurts a lot. And that is like the crisis moment, right? I think. That's the most difficult experience. And at that moment, people lose a lot of, often typically people lose a lot of confidence in themselves, right? They begin to think, oh my God, I've been pursuing a ghost, a dream, you know, empty, I'm deceiving myself. Why did I make this decision? What was wrong with me? You know, and so on. Or you can experience self-loathing, self-hatred. You know, it's very difficult. Those moments of rejection are very difficult to take, you know. And I think it's another reason why we need something like Zen, like Zazen, to help us deal with those experiences, to sort of like help us reconnect again. I mean, I think life is like a process of being disconnected, getting connected, getting disconnected, getting connected. It's inevitably the case that we're going to have these experiences of separation, you know, and they're very painful and difficult. But if you practice your Zen, you know, you learn how to cope with these problems. You learn how to reconnect. You know, things in life are going to, it's like the world is broken into pieces as we're growing up, and then we find a way to unify it, and it's heaven, but then it's broken into pieces again, and that's so difficult to take. But you know, if you can be grounded on the cushion, you know, you get back to your cushion, you get back to the moment. You get back to the moment, and you stay in the moment, and that sense of connection arises again, right? And you realize, I can do this. I can go on. You know, I can handle this. You know, and with the sense of connection, when it comes back, it restores your confidence in life, your trust, which we lose when sometimes people reject us. You know, and this is something especially, you know, creative people have to go through this. There's no way around it. You know, I was reading something about Van Gogh, Van Gogh, everybody says now. He was not a crazy person at all, no matter what people say. He was not a simple country person. Van Gogh had an incredible knowledge of art history. He had studied Western art and Asian art extensively. And he has all these notebooks where he talks about what he's doing in his paintings, and there's very detailed references to other artists, to other works. So he was really a hard-working artist, and he did these paintings that were breathtakingly beautiful paintings. And not a single one of them sold while he was alive. His brother was an art dealer, and he kept Vincent afloat, but financially. I think Van Gogh really killed himself because he just couldn't take rejection anymore. He was way ahead of all the other artists, and he was doing this stuff that was magnificent. And that's very painful, you know, to be creating something of such beauty, and to be alone with it, and try to share it with others, and they don't share. You know, that's very painful, right? And this happens to poets, this happens to writers. You know, people get in the Tao and they write a poem, or they get in the Tao and they write a novel, and then they take it out and they're expecting everybody to go, "Oh my God, this is fantastic." You know, there's a very famous American writer named Herman Melville. And Melville was an incredibly popular writer in the 19th century. He had been on sailing ships, and he wrote Tales of the Sea. And he became like Tom Clancy. He was very rich, and he was very popular. And then he got tired of writing these empty novels. And he started writing novels that were sort of weird and you know, very strange novels. He wrote Moby Dick. And Moby Dick is the weirdest book you'll ever read. It's like 800 pages long. It's so weird you probably won't finish it. But it was his masterpiece. You know, when he wrote that, he was in the Tao. And he had a good reputation, and they published Moby Dick, and it sank like a stone, right? And at the end of his life, Melville was completely forgotten, you know. And so he paid a big price for being true to his true nature. But he could have just cranked out these books, and that would have been unsatisfying to him. So he was true to his true nature. But the rejection is a real problem, right? It breaks the world. It's like it cuts off the energy again, right? So you have to be, you know, we Zen people have to be, you have to have those resources to get through that experience. You have to know how to ground yourself again in the energy. And Zazen is a way of grounding yourself in that energy again, you know. So that when these crises happen, you don't let them blow you about like the wind. And they're especially painful because we invest so much of ourselves in them, right? I mean, Barnett said he spends years on a painting. Years. He said, I won't finish the painting until I'm totally satisfied. So he said it sometimes takes him years to finish a painting. Now, you know, it's okay to spend years on a painting, but then you take it to the art dealer and the guy says, no, I don't want it. That's hard to take. But it's impossible to live a creative life. It's impossible to be alive, to live in a lively way and not have those disappointing experiences, you know. Even somebody, look, the Dalai Lama is somebody I find so interesting because, you know, at one time, quite recently, you know, Tibetan society really believed in enlightenment. The whole society was built around the pursuit of enlightenment. Really and truly, it's not a fantasy. Tibetan society had a lot of problems, but the society really was like dedicated to enlightenment. And just as we have like, kids grow up wanting to be baseball players, or they want to grow up to be Bill Gates, you know, in Tibet, kids wanted to grow up and be enlightened, you know. And the society was not perfect by any means. And it had a lot of problems, like any society. But it was really, in some ways, quite humane. I think quite a highly achieved society. So you know, the Dalai Lama grew up in that society as a little boy, and you know, the Dalai Lama did a lot of meditation and mastered all of these techniques of concentration and connection, and became deeply enlightened. And, the story should have been, you know, this. You know, the Tibetan people are good people. They cultivate awakening. Everybody respects them. They have a lovely time. Everybody's happy, right? And that's not what happened. You know, you get invaded. Your temples are torn down. People are killed. Again, your connection with the world is disconnected, right? And the Dalai Lama has to do a lot of sitting to deal with those events, right? I mean, but if you think about life, it's like this. Life is like this dialectic. I hate to use that word. Why don't I say like a dialogue between disconnection and connection. Disconnection and connection. All the time we're getting disconnected, and we have to reground ourselves in the world. We have to reground, reconnect. And so if you're disconnected, you can be very unhappy. A lot of people are neurotic. They take antidepressants. They're very disconnected. They're very alienated and unhappy. And you find something like Zazen, and you learn how to connect, right? But don't be deceived, you know. You're going to be challenged. You're going to be challenged. You're going to be knocked on your butt. You know, this also happens in something like personal relationships, you know. When I was in college, I met this woman, and I won't give you her last name, but her first name was Carol. And she was the most beautiful person I had ever met. I don't mean physically. She was quite attractive physically, but her heart was so good. She was going to be a doctor, and in fact, she became a doctor. I Googled once and found out she's a doctor. I thought, wow, she did it. But when I was in college, I had this crush on her. And I just felt, this is my destiny, right? I just thought, this woman is my destiny, you know? And we got along so well, you know? We were both in an anthropology class together, and after the anthropology class, we'd talk, and we'd walk along, and I just thought, this is it, baby, you know? I just thought, this is destiny, you know, destiny. And then one day I was, you know, kind of shy, so I said, you know, would you like to go out on a, you know, date, you know? And she said, no, I don't think so, you know? And she said, you're a nice guy, but I just don't think you're, you know, you're my type. She didn't say it like that. She said, you're a nice guy, but I just don't, she actually said, I don't want that kind of connection right now in my life. I don't want that in my life right now. But later, like about a year, you know, so we saw each other in, you know, now and again, and we were friendly, but about a year later, I saw her with this incredibly cool guy, you know? And he had long hair and a beard and sunglasses. He was so cool and he was so handsome. It just broke my heart. You know, it's like, oh. But she—I don't think she married him, fortunately. I'm happy to say. But the thing is, you know, I couldn't believe it. You know, how can the universe let me down like this, right? Because it felt so right. You know, so this is a real challenge. And you know, you can be in the Tao, you know, and you don't win the race, you don't get the blue ribbon for your painting, and that can be that's a most difficult moment. You have to live in the Tao, no matter what, right? That's some people are able to deal with this. You know, I think I'll wrap it up. But you know, Van Gogh's friend Paul Gauguin, was also able to deal with rejection because he was such an egomaniac, right? So he made everybody else unhappy, right? He Gauguin would seduce other people's wives. He would, you know, take money from other people. He pushed, you know, he was just kind of like total egomaniac. He took care of himself very well, and all he ever thought about was making himself happy, you know. And so he was able to get through these crises because he would just push the suffering on others, right? You know, Van Gogh was a very gentle person, and he always internalized all of this. He always felt like, oh, I'm no good, blah, blah, blah. You know, neither of these is like a good strategy. You have to try to develop a flexibility, you know, not to be crushed by rejection and defeat. It's very difficult, and because it undermines our sense of self-worth, right? But there's something deeper than self-worth even, which is this connectedness, right? If you live for self-worth, it's important to have a sense of self-worth, but even more powerful than that is this sense of connectedness, this trust in life. So if you can get to the level of trusting life again, you're going to be okay. You know, and the way to do that, in my experience, is to get on the cushion and be in the moment. And after a while, you feel like, okay, I'm connected again, yeah? See, sometimes life is connected, and when it's connected, it's like a dream. You know, the great Zen master Nyogen Senzaki, one of his last words were, like a dream, like a dream. And basically, the highest ideal in Japanese Zen is this life where you're not disconnected at all anymore. You've been disconnected, you've reconnected, you've been disconnected, you've reconnected, and finally, things don't shake you. You don't get knocked out of that connected consciousness anymore. You're there all the time, and then life is like a dream. See, that's what that meant. In a dream, Kyozan Osho went to Maitreya's palace and was led to sit in the third seat. A senior monk struck with a gavel and said, "Today the one in the third seat will speak." Kyozen rose and, striking with the gavel, said, "The truth of the Mahayana is beyond the four propositions and transcends the 100 negations. Hear the truth." See, it's not what he said. It's how, where he was. He was in that place. See, he was in that connected place. Mumon's comment. Now tell me, did Kyozan preach or did he not? If he opens his mouth, he's lost. If he closes his mouth, he's lost. Even if he neither opens his, nor shuts his mouth, he's 108,000 miles away from the truth. See, Mumon is blowing smoke in our eyes. He means connect. Be connected. Be connected. Mumon's verse. In broad daylight, under the blue sky, he forges a dream in a dream. He makes up a monstrous story and tries to deceive the whole crowd.